right. Well, welcome into the Chris Collinsworth podcast, the April, what is this, fifth edition. And coming off the national championship game last night, Austin Gale, Brad Spielberger here, our resident draft, social media, salary cap. We've got experts of all kind on the program today. So how are you guys? Did you guys stay up late and watch that thing last night?
Absolutely. Go Rock Chalk, baby. Go Kansas.
I had them. I didn't bet them, obviously, but I had them on my Twitter account. That to me, it feels like a bigger bet than money sometimes. You go on there and you get that. So we're driving back. I've got to come from Orlando, and I'm driving back, and I'm listening to the first half on the radio, and I'm like, oh, my God. So you jump out 7-0. I go, beautiful. I got this right. I'm so smart. And pretty soon they're down 15. I'm like, what in the heck has happened to this basketball team? And I come back and turn it on, and they look exactly like the Kansas team I thought I was going to see all along. What happened in the first half? They were so bad.
It's hard to say, right? I mean, I think a lot of it was just kind of slow starts, but ultimately the offensive rebounds for UNC like kind of kept them giving them life, but their stars could not hit their shots. When you can't hit shots in the national championship, Kansas has so many playmakers, McCormick especially, it's tough. And I do think that Kansas ultimately was the better team, even going into the half, down 15. I thought a lot of that second life from UNC was offensive rebounds, but they still couldn't hit enough shots to kind of keep pace as the game progressed.
Did you watch any of it, Brad?
Yeah, no, I watched the whole thing as well. I think a couple injuries for UNC played a role too. I know he stayed in the game, but that big guy, Manic, who I think was concussed at some point in that game, couldn't hit a shot at all. And then, yeah, Bacote, who hurt his ankle, against Duke, and then re-rolled the ankle again in that game. And I think that's when McCormick, who I think is probably the best player on the floor in that game last night, he just went off at that point.
That was one of the great plays I've ever seen in a big moment, that he missed the shot, got his own rebound, basically slugged his way back in there against two guys and hit that jump hook. That was clutch. It was cool. Fun stuff. So now we go on to the national championships of the NFL draft, because this is getting a little bit hot and hairy here as we speak. And we had a little action go down during the last couple of days here with the New Orleans Saints. If you're not following it closely, this may have seemed like a let's just reshuffle the deck and we'll pass the cards back out here. But if you look at this from the lens of the Philadelphia Eagles, they get another year to look at their quarterback and figure out whether or not Jalen Hurts is going to be the guy, which I think they're going to do anyway. And then flip some draft capital and multiple picks into the following season, which if they want to get it back into a draft class for quarterbacks, I think most people would say odds are that may be a better class.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the Eagles essentially go from pick number 16 in the 2022 NFL draft down to 18, only two slots, and pick up a round three pick, the pick 101 in doing so. And then the other pick, right, they trade away number 19 overall, a mid-tier first rounder, for a first in 2023 and a second in 2024, which is just like insane value for the Philadelphia Eagles to get a first and a second for a current first round pick. I think one on the Saints side, Mickey Loomis obviously has his eyes set on a handful of players in this class and wants to make sure he can get his hands on two of them. And then for the Philadelphia Eagles, they're just pushing things into next year, knowing that they can continue to evaluate the quarterback position this season and look at the 2023 class, which C.J. Stroud, Ohio State, Bryce Young, Alabama, Will Levis, Kentucky, even D.J. Uiagalelei of Clemson. Like, there's going to be a lot of really talented quarterback prospects in this upcoming class that I think the Eagles are smart to push some of that capital in next year and pick up a lot of surplus value.
Yeah, I think we all get this from the Philadelphia standpoint, or at least I do. I feel like I understand it. Do it from the New Orleans standpoint, because now this gets really interesting. There's something going on. So you get two middle round picks. I think you guys have determined they come up to about 4 or 5, something like that. If they package those two together, they could jump up into the 4 or 5 range. They lose Tron Armstead. Does this now say anything about their feelings about Jameis Winston, who, you know, if you're thinking Malik Willis at this point, I would argue, okay, you've got that same kind of a quarterback. Now Jameis doesn't run like Malik Willis, But the bizarre thought in the back of my mind was Kenny Pickett. Mm-hmm. I mean, Drew Brees, for all those years, played a style that is not that much unlike what Kenny Pickett plays, not the biggest guy in the world, hand size, whatever. It's, you know, I can picture Drew Brees standing on his tippy toes trying to stand over the offensive line. And you've got Dennis Allen now as the head football coach. And what do all defensive coordinators want in life? They want one thing and one thing only. They want their defense to be taken care of. And damn it, quarterback, don't screw it up. Don't throw an interception. Don't fumble the ball. Don't leave it on my end of the field. Because if I hold people under 20 points, I'm going to, at the very least, be a defensive coordinator for the rest of my life. And don't give me one of those quarterbacks who's going to keep giving the ball to the other team. Now, Jameis didn't do that much last year. He was better at all that. But if you're looking at this from the Saints standpoint, is it strictly quarterback? Is it Teron Armstead? Are they trying to get one of those big three offensive linemen? This gets really interesting.
Yeah, my opinion of it, and I think it may be different, is how some people are viewing it. I think there is a possibility, right, that they package both picks to go to number 5 overall to get ahead of the Carolina Panthers and get what could be the quarterback one in this class in either Malik Willis or you go grab Kenny Pickett of Pittsburgh. I'm more of the opinion that they are targeting specifically getting ahead of the receiver needy teams at 19, right? Once you look at the Packers with two picks after the first 20, the Chiefs need a receiver now with Tyreek Hill gone. They have the number 19 overall selection to go lock in on a wide receiver. And the number 16 overall selection gets them ahead of the Chargers, who need an offensive tackle. They don't want to start Storm Norton at right tackle opposite Rashawn Slater next year. So now they get ahead of the Chargers going from 18 to 16 and can go get, say, Trevor Penning at 16. There's thoughts that Charles Cross of Mississippi State could fall to 16. So I think they're looking to attack two specific needs, wide receiver and offensive tackle. I think they feel good about those two classes specifically if they can get ahead of some of the other teams that they know are going to be locking into those positions as well, as you say.
All right. I thought of all that too. Okay. I'm in. I understand exactly what you're saying. Mm-hmm. But did you do it too early? In other words, now you've given them, you know, basically the entirety of the month of April to go make a counterpunch. And if those teams want to now go jump the Saints, they still have time to do it.
I mean, it's an interesting thought, too, because there's some teams that I think would be looking to trade down. Minnesota at 12, maybe. Houston at 13. It's their second first-round pick. Maybe they look to trade down. So, yeah, you do open the door for potentially someone then leapfrogging you again, and you're kind of left, you know, not getting the guys you were targeting. But I would say trying to apply conventional logic to the Saints is a fool's errand, because they just do what they want to do. They operate differently. They don't care about – I mean, from every value chart, they got killed in this trade, but they just don't care.
They were the Rams before the Rams a little bit, you know. I mean, it's like, okay, all 30 teams look at it this way, and then we've got the Saints and we've got the Rams who are just taking a different approach, you know. That and there's nothing wrong with that, right? I mean, because let's face it, the Saints, how long ago was it? 3 years ago, they hit the mother load of all drafts. It's like everybody they took in that draft was, you know, ended up being a great player for them, drags them into the playoffs, and they do some good things. So, I mean, is this crazy? Are we talking about now with the salary cap? I've been reading all these articles. Does the salary cap even matter? Is this just all like a fake thing?
I do think part of this is salary cap related, and that they need contributors for the next couple of years, and they can't necessarily go out and spend in free agency on all of them. So they have three top 50 picks now in this draft, and I think they want three guys that are at least contributing, if not starting right away, just because you have that surplus value on those contracts. So it is part of it. And then, you know, the Jameis component as well, 2-year deal, basically a 1-year deal. So maybe, you know, quarterback is the consideration there. And if you have a rookie, you know, a rookie contract quarterback, then the salary cap becomes much easier to deal with.
I could see that. I could definitely see that, you know, and they're paying Jameis, what, 27, 28. I mean, it's not outrageous. It's not here. I'm so intrigued with this, because you can make an argument, and I think Seattle is the really interesting case study right now. Is Seattle, are they just don't care? They're just going to give it up and go for the top quarterback next year, or Are we still going to see something to come from the Seattle Seahawks?
Yeah, I think the Seattle situation is interesting, right? I think a big factor in this, I don't know how much is being talked about, but Pete Carroll is the oldest coach in the NFL. And I don't know necessarily how interested he is in a rookie rebuild, right? You say you do get Malik Willis at number 9 overall, or you say, you move up to try and get a quarterback. Is he going to be a part of this, this rebuild with a rookie quarterback and a really bad roster? This isn't a good offensive line. They're shopping DK Metcalf, or at least that's what the rumors are. The defense doesn't have a lot of talent outside of Jamal Adams, who plays a low value position. Bringing in a rookie quarterback into this situation, it's not going to perform better than what you had with Russell Wilson. So I think it's more likely that they punt on this quarterback class, commit to Drew Lock and picking in the top 5 next year, and then probably reset at the 2023 quarterback class, where there's, I think, going to be better options for them. And like I said, CJ Stroud, Will Levis, some of these other guys.
The league is so bizarre right now. I mean, the idea that DK Metcalf is on the block, I mean, I get it when you look at the wide receiver salaries that have been happening here lately, and maybe you just, Pete just goes, I don't value wide receivers that much. I can go find some of these guys, and we know that this class has a lot of receivers. Now, maybe they don't have the top of the list, but, I mean, you go put on the tape of that Drake London, and, I've never seen a contested catch guy like that. I mean, he just looks like a power forward out there rebounding the ball half the time. So, Brad, what do you make of the wide receivers becoming available sort of debate that's going on right now?
Yeah, I mean, I think as the market continues to go up for the veterans, and then at the same time, as we see year in and year out the last 3 or 4 drafts now, where you can find day one starters in the second and third round at wide receiver, that those two competing forces are leading to a lot of these teams to maybe not want to pay top dollar. With the Seahawks specifically, they just extended Tyler Lockett last offseason as well. So you're going to have, as Austin mentioned, arguably the worst offensive line in football, and then a receiver making $17 million per year in Lockett and, I don't know, 22 whatever million per year for DK. That's just probably not a smart way to build a roster. So, it's not just them, though. It sounds like A.J. Brown is frustrated in Tennessee. Sounds like maybe Terry McLaurin in Washington can come available. That seems crazy to me. But, yeah, I think teams are balking at these numbers right now with these contracts, now that Devontae Adams and Tyreek Hill have kind of shifted the market.
Amari Cooper moving on to Cleveland. I mean, this is really getting to be – I feel like – so I have my degree in accounting. I feel like I'm back in accounting class now. I feel like that it's not so much football related. I mean, nobody can look at Metcalf and go, oh, he can't help us, right? But he can help us at what price, and what it went to $210 million cap, something like that this year. What's your gut feeling out of what we're learning out of the deals that have been made here, Brad, as far as tackles? Moving on with Teron Armstead, these wide receivers, Aaron Rodgers' new contract. What are the takeaways now that we're thinking about?
Yeah, I mean, I still honestly think there's room for more growth. These receiver deals were kind of misreported. In reality, Devontae Adams about $22.5 million per year, Tyreek Hill about $24, $25 million per year. But still, I mean, I think we're going to see an explosion even in the near future. I think Aaron Donald's going to sign an extension that shocks people in the next couple months. I think Nick Bosa, if he's healthy and San Fran wants to extend him early, could be our first $30 million per year defensive player. Like, I think it's still kind of in the early stages, but I think everyone sees where we're headed in the near future.
And what about San Francisco? What do they do now with Garoppolo? I mean, are you willing to roll the dice that you've made? Okay, you make it the deal, you give up all the draft picks. Are you ready to go with Trey and just go screw it? I'm good.
See, that's the thing that's scary. There is, it's a $24 million salary, and it's not so much that's a bad value for Jimmy Garoppolo, but you're trying to extend Deebo Samuel and Nick Bosa, build around your rookie contract quarterback, and you can't really do that if you're spending so much money on another quarterback.
I also feel that, you know, I don't know how Shanahan, who obviously was a big, you know, big part of the push to trade two future first rounders to go get Trey Lance. I don't know how he puts a plan together to ownership that doesn't have Trey Lance starting. Right? Like, I don't know how you do it. Like, you make this goal of like, hey, we're going to, you know, sit him behind Jimmy Garoppolo and develop him and all this stuff. And then year two, that's when we'll give him this opportunity. I just don't think you could go back on that, right? With how much they've invested in Trey Lance, I think you have to kind of go with the bet you play. So they put all their chips in the middle of the table and now they're just not, you know, they're not leveraging it. Right. So I do think that Trey Lance ultimately is the starter this year and Jimmy Garoppolo could be on the move.
It is so interesting to me. You know, I'm putting my accountant hat back on here again. And if I'm not getting the value for Jimmy Garoppolo that I want, long-term, just stay with me here, am I not better off playing him and trying to trade him with the first major injury that happens? You know, all this stuff is just like one big shell game right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, 100%. And I think it's the situations at a couple buildings where I think as there's been so much movement, teams also are kind of using leverage against them. Like, no one wants to trade for Baker Mayfield because they know Cleveland has no leverage now. With Garoppolo, as Austin mentioned, like, yes, they could start him in theory. Yes, he played some good ball in the playoffs last year, but every team knows they want to start Trey Lance, and that's the plan. And so maybe the offers are so underwhelming to where they're kind of sitting there being like, we can't take this deal. It's such a bad deal, even though we do want to move him.
Well, maybe we go Jimmy Garoppolo for Baker Mayfield. They both add value with the other teams. They both might have to play right away. I mean, you could definitely see a scenario in Cleveland where Jimmy Garoppolo would have to come in there and play for 2 months if Deshaun's suspended. I mean, it feels like what the Rams did. Now, maybe I'm just way. It feels like what the Rams did to win that Super Bowl has just changed the gut feeling of so many owners or general managers or coaches, and that the window for success is shrinking so much. The expectations are so high for these GMs to make deals to go win a Super Bowl right now that the long-term planning of the NFL just seems like, even for Pete Carroll, it almost seems like it's bizarre now. Like, what? You're going to have like a 2 or 3 year plan to try and go rebuild a football team? That doesn't make any sense at all. We just saw the Rams win the Super Bowl.
No, I would agree. And I think it has put more emphasis on the draft and developing a talent, you know, a talented roster, right? You know, the Los Angeles Rams don't make that trade for Matthew Stafford if they didn't draft well and develop a lot of talent there with Cooper Kupp, Robert Woods, and who they had. I think it's very similar to, you know, people like going and trying to get this quarterback, like the Denver Broncos, right? Have drafted really well. It's a very talented roster. It feels like it's a quarterback away. It's exactly what they did when they signed Peyton Manning, right? And they were able to kind of pursue a Super Bowl that way. I think there's two ways now that you can develop a Super Bowl competitive team. It's drafting really well and then making a big push for a quarterback, or hitting on a quarterback and on a rookie contract, right? And I think the other is, I think we're seeing teams see that the other is a lot easier, right? Hitting on other positions and developing a really talented roster, and then maybe going getting a Matthew Stafford or a Peyton Manning or a Russell Wilson could be the situation that more teams do, because it's so difficult, right, to one, hit on a quarterback prospect, develop him in the right offense, and then build around him. And then when you get to this point where you're on this second contract, you find yourself like the Kansas City Chiefs. Kansas City Chiefs are moving on from Tyreek Hill, or even the Dallas Cowboys moving on from Amari Cooper, Lael Collins, developing this quarterback on this rookie contract just to pay him a monster second contract. If your roster's not good enough, you're going to find yourself in a position where you got to move on from some guys.
The Chris Collinsworth podcast is sponsored by Western and Southern Financial Group. And while you focus on all these roster moves we're talking about with the draft, Western and Southern helps advance your money moves. And if you're buying your first home, we were all there planning to start a family, all there too. Wondering how to make your money grow, all there three. Western and Southern's playbook of life insurance, investment, and retirement solutions helps you to rest assured on game day. So team up to understand needs and address goals with a game plan built just for you. Let's get started at westernsouthern.com/PFF. Right now, you can get 25% off any PFF subscription if you use code Collinsworth. There you go. And what can you get with a PFF subscription? Well, first and foremost, all that locked article content. You can't believe how much is behind the paywall there. And the NFL Draft Guide, the most remarkable draft guide. I've had multiple people in the NFL tell me how much they rely on it. And the completely unlocked mock draft simulator, probably the greatest tool we've ever built at PFF. And the 2022 free agent rankings, which is going to carry right over into the season, help you get ready for those fantasy drafts. And data, grades, and the entire 2021 season, which will be there. And obviously, as you start to get ready, you can look at everything that happened in every season past. So there's so much more. Support the podcast. Use promo code Collinsworth for 25% off any sub. DraftKings Sportsbook is an official sports betting partner of the NFL. You can download the DraftKings Sportsbook app today and use code SPORTS for a special offer when you sign up. That's code SPORTS only at DraftKings Sportsbook. So I want you to tell me, Austin, a little bit about Sam Howell. So, of course, this is the year that I decide to do my draft prep in a different way. I thought the top three quarterbacks were Kenny Pickett, Desmond Ridder, and Malik Willis. So I study them. But now I'm just trying to go, like, in the order of the draft. So I want to do the offensive lineman, the defensive lineman. I want to do, and we'll talk about Aiden here in a minute. And I want to do it that way. I've never done it that way. I've always just gone position by position by position. So I missed Sam Howell. And Sam Howell, we've got at PFF, is the top guy on the board, right?
Yep, we do have him as the top quarterback.
Tell me about Sam Howell. I want to hear about Sam Howell, the North Carolina quarterback.
Yeah, so Sam Howell, I don't think is being effectively viewed as the top quarterback prospect in this class. I currently have him as my QB3 behind Desmond Ridder and Malik Willis. And I think his skill set to Malik Willis's is not all that dissimilar. He has a rocket arm, a howitzer of an arm, one of the best deep ball throwers in this class, very similar size, 6'2", 220. And everyone talks about Malik Willis's athleticism and his ability as a runner. But Sam Howell led the Power 5 in forced missed tackles at the quarterback position last year, right? Like, he was a really effective runner for UNC this past year. And the reason I'm also buying into his development, right, is that he has 2 years of really productive play as a true sophomore and true junior in college football. He's one of the youngest quarterback prospects in this year's class. You think about his 23-year-old season. When will we see his 23-year-old season? It won't be until his second year in the NFL. Guess what? Kenny Pickett's already 23 years old. And we've already seen that 23-year-old season. And it was in the ACC against bad defenses in college. So I'm betting on Sam Howell as his body develops and he matures and plays the position more, being one of the top quarterback prospects in this class. I don't think his skill set is all that dissimilar to Malik Willis's, right? I think he can hit the deep ball. He's not overly accurate. Malik Willis isn't either, but he also has really good pocket presence and can navigate the pocket well. Not as good as Desmond Ridder. It's a big reason why I have the Cincinnati quarterback as my top quarterback in this class. But Howell, in my opinion, is still should comfortably be a top quarterback in this class and held in similar regard to Malik Willis, who's obviously being mocked as high as number two to the Detroit Lions.
All right. I Brad, give me a little bit of your thought on not only Sam Howell, but Desmond Ridder, because Austin's hit on something for me, and this is going to sound so outrageously stupid, I'm tempted to not say it, but Lamar Jackson, when he came out, was a pocket passer. That was to me the most stunning part of watching him on tape, because every highlight that I had ever seen on him was, you know, he's running around like a crazy person and making everybody on the football field miss and going in. But when you watch the tape of him, you go, he wants to sit in the pocket and throw the ball. And that combination took him to the Most Valuable Player Award, which is, you know, we'll take that at the quarterback position. Is it possible that Desmond Ridder, running 4.5, doesn't have nearly the moves, the, you know, make people miss, none of that stuff? But how much do you really want your quarterback running in the NFL in a 17-game season, as opposed to you want the possibility of your quarterback running in a 17-game season? And is Desmond Ridder the possibility of running enough when you combine it with the fact that he's also sort of a pocket passer in his heart?
I think it reminds me of Justin Fields a little bit too, where he ran like a 4.4 and everyone kind of thought of him as a runner and he had some plays, but he really does rather sit in the pocket, go through all of his progressions, try to find something first and then bail. But I think the value in scrambling has probably gone up as passing has increased. I mean, the more that you're running downfield routes and having longer progressing things, the more that everyone's dropping back. And then if you do have that athletic quarterback that can hit a top speed pretty quickly, they can get, you know, chunk yardage. Mahomes has been doing it forever, where everyone's deep downfield covering all their guys and he gets an easy 10 yards because there's just no one around. The funny thing with Ridder is that I feel like in many ways, he's the most pro-ready, but then when you do watch him, he does make some kind of head-scratching throws and tries to force things every once in a while, which I guess every quarterback can do. But I'm with Austin. I'm a huge fan of his. I don't think he's being talked about enough either, really.
Did the Alabama game just kill him? I mean, let's face it. They were all a bit overmatched. They were competitive. I thought defensively, UC really played well. Of course, Alabama had some missing receivers and all that. But did the Alabama game just knock his stock down, or was he always sort of where he was?
I don't think it knocked his stock down. I think it's important to also like kind of provide the context that like none of these quarterbacks I think would even be top five quarterback prospects in last year's class, right? I think all this quarterback class is significantly worse than what it was last year. It's going to be worse than what it was next year. I think Desmond Ridder in last year's class doesn't come off the board until maybe round two, round three. But because there's a lot of incomplete prospects in this class. Malik Willis isn't accurate, doesn't throw from the pocket. Sam Howell only has 2 years of starter level experience and had a significant drop off when De'Ami Brown, Javonte Williams, and these guys left. Kenny Pickett has small hands and wears two gloves and isn't super effective with the deep ball. There's all these different things, right? He's not a great processor either. I think with Desmond Ridder, he has, in my opinion, the most projectable tape of any of the quarterbacks in this class. Can navigate the pocket, fundamentally sound, experience in it, like a pro style. I hate the term pro style because nothing's pro style anymore. Everyone runs a different offense, but there's NFL throws on Desmond Ridder's tape, hitting the dig at the second level consistently, hitting the post. It's not all RPOs and play action and single vertical concepts. Like, he actually makes NFL throws consistently, and he's done so in that system. He checks his own protections, which is one of the few quarterbacks that does that in this class. If you are drafting Desmond Ridder, you're drafting him to start early, right, and take advantage of that cheaper rookie contract with Howell, Willis, even Pickett. I think you're drafting them for what they could be in the future, right, and less so what they are right now.
I just wonder if a team is – do you have to draft these guys to play right away? Because let's face it, we all, you know, we're having coronaries last year about this draft class of quarterbacks and how great they are. And it ends up, if you're going to pick one, probably Mac Jones played the best of all of them a season ago. And how good was that? So if this class is a notch below that, do we really even care in the short term other than what they might develop? So if that's the case, how about a Baltimore or a New Orleans instead of Taysom Hill being the backup down there, that, you know, we're going to take a Ridder or a Willis and we're going to slowly work them in and not dump it all on them right away. And if it works out, that's great. If it doesn't work out, then you stay with what you have. But obviously with the Ravens last year, I mean, Lamar goes down and they can't find their way out of a paper sack at the end of the season. I mean, it really cost them the possibility of getting into the playoffs. So are we expecting too much out of any rookie draft class?
My opinion on that is, honestly, I think the league has changed to where you're drafting quarterbacks and catering your offense to their skill set, right? We saw that with the Baltimore Ravens and Lamar Jackson. We saw that with Brian Daboll and Josh Allen. And that, you know, offensive coordinators have taken to that so much that you can now play your quarterback right away because you're playing in their system, right? You're creating a system for your rookie quarterback. I think in the past, you know, offensive coordinators and coaching staffs were so much more adamant in, we're drafting a quarterback to play in my system. And guess what? You're going to have to sit a year to play in my system because you're not going to know all the nomenclature and all these different things. Now it's like, we just drafted Josh Allen. We are changing our entire offense to fit his skill set because that's how you win in the NFL. You know, Josh Allen's offense looks completely different than what Lamar Jackson's is, completely different than what Patrick Mahomes looks like, because offensive coordinators, I think, you know, successful coaches are adapting to this idea that we are bringing in guys that can do X, Y, and Z, and our offense is going to highlight that. If they can't do Q or R, we're not going to have that in our offense, right? You don't see a lot of, you know, over the middle stuff in Lamar Jackson or outside the number stuff on Lamar Jackson's offense, right? You don't want him, you know, forcing the ball on the outside on that 10 to 19 yard level because he's not the most accurate quarterback in the NFL. What you do see a lot of is a lot of running the football, vertical lead concepts, stuff over the middle of the field where he's had a lot of success at Louisville. And I think Josh Allen, you run the ball with him. You get the ball downfield. You create this vertical offense. So I'm of the opinion now today's NFL is so adaptive to what a quarterback's strengths are, you play them right away, which is why, again, you go back to the San Francisco 49ers situation and you're so surprised at how they're approaching it. And I think Kyle Shanahan's approach with rookies specifically has been highlighted at times. I don't know if he's gotten enough scrutiny or criticism for the development of Brandon Ayuk, you know, the development of Dante Pettis, you know, what he's done with Trey Lance now, not letting them see the field early on in their tenures. And maybe they're in the doghouse for whatever reason. I'm of the opinion, right? I'm of the opinion that you want to get guys to see the field and play them in roles where they're going to have success. And I think that's really important with this quarterback class as well. I think sitting them behind other veteran quarterbacks maybe does afford you more wins in 2022. But if your number one goal is to develop a quarterback in this class, I think playing them right away in an offense that fits their skill set is probably your best case scenario.
Brad, what are you thinking on this?
No, an interesting thought tied to your kind of thinking of having a good backup. I think Jalen Hurts, when he was drafted by the Eagles, the thought was we will have a very cheap backup quarterback that we like, that if Carson Wentz gets hurt, as he had 2 years in a row before that, we are not going to, like you said, down the stretch, if we need the last four games of the year, we're fighting for a wild card spot and we need to go 2-2 versus 1-3 or 0-4, we have Jalen Hurts. And I think that was the initial plan there. And some teams probably should explore that more, where, like you're saying, if one of these guys does fall, to the second round, and maybe you grab a Matt Corral or something like that for a good team that has a bridge guy, knows they're going to move on eventually, but does not want to start this guy from day one. I think more teams should consider that. I hear what Austin's saying 100%, and that if you're looking for the ceiling, if you want to develop the guy the most, you should play him right away. But even tying it back to the start of this whole conversation, the only reason I think Malik Willis at number 2 overall to Detroit makes any sense whatsoever, it's because he would have a redshirt year behind Jared Goff. I wouldn't let him play a snap in 2022, and then I would want to start him week 1, 2023.
I'm with you on Malik Willis. I mean, I see everything. I see all the physical skills. You see the arm strength. You see the whole thing. But, I mean, he has some development to do, right? I mean, unless you're just going to go set up a Lamar Jackson offense and then let's let him go play. Please, God, though, don't tell me that we're going to get the offense now where they go up to the line of scrimmage, they have to start the film, and they look at now the entire offense, the offensive line, everybody stands up, turns around, gets the new play call from the coach. I'm like, oh, please just make that illegal. That adds at least an hour to every game tape that you have to watch in college football as they try to do that. Yeah, you guys give me something that we're not thinking about on this draft so far. Is there a player? Is there a group of players? Is there a position that is underrated that we're going to come out of the first couple of rounds of the draft and go, oh, man, nobody was talking about that, but I was thinking that.
I do think a player that's probably wrongfully falling in this class is Derek Stingley Jr., the LSU cornerback. I think he is one of the younger players in this class. I think he's a true junior. Obviously did not get to see the production or even just the snap experience that you wanted after his true freshman season. A lot of injuries kind of derailed that in 2020 and 2021. But you go back to that 2019 season that Derek Stingley had as a true freshman, 18 years old in the SEC. It's, I think, one of the best defensive performances we'll ever see in a single season ever. I mean, like from a college perspective, at 18 years old to do what he did against an NFL flight of receivers in the SEC, I thought was really impressive. And I don't think it's going to be done again. Like Derek Stingley is 1-on-1 in that area. And I think he's being brought down boards. You hear, some conversations at the combine that he's not an alpha. He's not a chirpy corner. He doesn't live, breathe football. And, I push back on a lot of that stuff, right? I think what he did in 2019, you're going to need to love football to do that. And I don't care if you're chirpy or not, if you're having that production as an 18-year-old in the SEC against Devontae Smith and Seth Williams and all these really talented receivers, it's really impressive. You go back to some of the practice tape, seeing Derek Stingley Jr. against Ja'Marr Chase and Justin Jefferson, this guy's hanging with those guys that are top flight NFL receivers now at 18 years old. I'm buying into that kind of breakout, right? I'm buying into that, even though injuries have kind of derailed any further production for him. You still see him some of the flashes. His pro day, I think it's in the next few days here. I think he has an opportunity to be, you know, maybe move himself back into the top 10 conversation if the athletic testing matches the eye test. But even if it doesn't, I think if you get him to Minnesota at 12, Baltimore at 14, he's going to be one of the steals of the draft.
I'll stick with the cornerback position itself. I think, and it's maybe not super underrated, but a quote that stuck out to me, Eric DaCosta, the GM of the Ravens at the Combine, said, you know, we see starting caliber guys on day three at the cornerback position. And then another GM basically said the exact same thing. Like, there's a ton of depth there, a lot of really good players. One guy that I like, I think, more than some people, not that he's a sleeper or anything, but a guy out of your alma mater, Chris, and Kyer Elam. You throw on the tape against Alabama. I mean, he is hanging with those guys the entire game. I just think he has kind of that long range. I think he is a bit more of an alpha, I guess, so to speak, or at least he plays like it. There's a lot of really good corners. I know Daxton Hill out of Michigan is getting a lot of buzz now. I admittedly need to go watch some more of him, but you just keep seeing names come up, and I feel like there could be a run on a lot of talented cornerbacks.
I had Sam Flood, president of NBC Sports, say something I thought was really smart. The fact that Darryl Stingley Jr. is even playing football is borderline remarkable. I mean, you know what I mean? It's like, how could you not have that as part of your brain from the time you were born that, you know, what happened? It's amazing. But I'll say this too. I had in my college career a huge sophomore year. We had a quarterback that was just going to sling it and didn't care. We had Steve Spurrier as the offensive coordinator on that team. And I put up my biggest numbers of my college career in my sophomore year. Sometimes it has a lot to do with the surroundings of what's going on, whether or not a guy can play. I don't know. But the fact that you saw that high level, because when I'm doing the draft, a lot of times I'll go to their top end plays on the PFF with the tape, and I'll go to the bottom. So I want to see the extremes. I want to see their best. I want to see their worst. And, you know, if you've seen that level of play in the SEC for an extended period of time, I've seen a couple things where he's going to go out of the first round. I just don't see it. He's not the alpha male. He's not. I'll tell you, a million great players that weren't the alpha males strutting around the locker room like a peacock, but they just walked out there and played great. So, who knows? We have some good stuff coming up at PFF here in the very, very short term. Give us a little bit of the Aiden Hutchinson and exactly what's going on with that show.
Yeah, we're super excited. April 13th, in the next few days here, we're going to release a four-part podcast series on Aiden Hutchinson. It's called Hutch. We've interviewed him extensively, over 6 hours of, you know, interviews with Aiden Hutchinson, also interviewed his family and more than 40 other people a part of this project to really tell his story, which is a massive shout out to our director of communications, David Sofaro, who is a Michigan alum and has helped us really connect with a lot of talented people that can tell his story best, right? Head coach Jim Harbaugh, former coach Don Brown, Quiddy Pay, who's a former teammate of Aiden Hutchinson, and his roommate, Julius Welshoff, the linebacker, Josh Ross, Adam Schefter, Peter King, Field Yates, talking to all these people about Aiden Hutchinson, right? And I really do see this piece as an opportunity to tell the makings of a number one overall pick, right? We haven't had this kind of content come out on a projected number one overall pick before the draft in a really long time, right? Kyler Murray, Baker Mayfield, Joe Burrow, you look at some of the content that's come out on him, not a lot of extensive looks at their upbringing, right? Talking to his dad for an hour and a half, you find out he was into dance at first, then longboarding, and then he goes lacrosse, then track and soccer. And to hear just kind of his development as a player and his development as a human being and as a leader is all so impressive. And then you factor in this 2021 season, right? He's coming off a broken ankle that really, he was going to go into the 2021 NFL draft if he did not get hurt in 2020. ends up getting hurt, misses the entirety of his junior season, decides to come back with this mentality that I'm coming back to win and beat Ohio State. He obviously does that the first time Michigan has beat Ohio State in over 10 years. And a big part of that is why his legacy at Michigan is going to be something insane, in addition to his dad's, right? Chris Hutchinson also wearing the number 97. And now he's the makings of a number one overall pick, a culture changer in the NFL, a high floor producer. So one of my favorite people that I've talked to in this pre-draft process, in addition to his dad and his mom. And I really do think when this comes out on April 13th, a lot of people are going to come away really impressed with just the consistency he brings on and off the field, right? I mean, this is a guy that at Michigan, strength and conditioning coach Ben Herbert told me they test 41 different KPIs, neck flexibility, femur strength, all this stuff. He, over the last 2 years, across 41 different KPIs, key performance indicators, was the highest rated Michigan player over the last 2 years. His athleticism, his flexibility, his strength is just different. And I think that, combined with the motor, combined with the consistency you see off the field, is just going to be the makings of a really impressive player in the NFL.
I'm looking forward to that. I know in your heart, though, I've heard enough of your podcast that Kayvon Thibodeau out of Oregon is a guy that you really like. and it's got to be tough, right? I mean, here we are, we're pitching the podcast, and but whether it's Austin Collinsworth, who played at Notre Dame, the PFF grades are the PFF grades. We pull no punches with anybody. And I agree with you. I think that Thibodeau has a chance to be something really unique. I look at Aiden Hutchinson and I see Chris Long, who was a really good player for a long time, incredible effort, a guy with top-end athletic skills, maybe not the top-end athletic skills. So I'm interested in what you were saying about Ohio State there. But do you think that the off the field, or the questions about, you know, how he approached the media, if you will, I'm just going to leave it at that, in Indianapolis, had any impact on this, or is this just strictly comparing two football players?
So for me, Kayvon Thibodeau, I think, should 100% be in consideration for the number one overall pick. I think he's that talented of a player. He wins early in the snap. He's really explosive, a high-end athlete, and has bend and kind of a get-off that Aiden Hutchinson doesn't have. Like, he has win
Miles Garrett kind of stuff.
Yeah, it's Miles Garrett kind of stuff, right? And I think a lot of – you know, some of the conversation around him, I think, has been exaggerated, right? The effort concerns on tape, I think, are exaggerated. His poor run defense, I think, is exaggerated. He's a talented run defender. And I think if you have concerns with Kayvon Thibodeau, it should be concerns about his production, right? Playing in the Pac-12 and not having high-end production year in and year out, I think, is concerning. And everyone's like, well, he got double-teamed and they schemed against him. Absolutely. Aiden Hutchinson got that same stuff. I'll tell you that right now. And I think he obviously, he'll move past that in an objectively better conference that turns out more offensive tackle talent up there with the SEC. And as for the concerns off the field, I think a lot of it comes to intimidation, right? Kayvon Thibodeau is someone that is looking to maximize his brand in every single way. And that is something that we applaud for some people and don't for others, for whatever reason. I think when you think about coaches in the NFL and long-term evaluators, guys that have been in this league for a long time, hearing that a guy has his own cryptocurrency and releases NFTs is intimidating. And it can be billed as, to the wrong person, as uncoachability or a lack of desire in football. To me, I think it's just newness, right? I think it's not that he's uncoachable. It's just you don't know how to coach him. And I think that it's going to require someone that can really understand that, right? That gives him the benefit of the doubt on a lot of these things and can buy into the fact that, yeah, he wants to maximize his brand, but he's also a really high effort football player that has done everything up to this point to be a really good football player. Work ethic concerns throw out the window. This guy every hour sets an alarm to do 100 pushups, regardless of where he's at. This is a different type of dude. And I think, again, I think the effort concerns are exaggerated. The off-field interests are billed as negative when they're really a positive. I'm a big Kayvon Thibodeau guy. I think he, Aiden Hutchinson, even Evan Neal, Ike Ekwonu should all be in consideration for the number one overall pick.
It would take me an hour to do 100 pushups, so I don't think I could not sure I could do that thing. Brad, anything else that sticks out in your mind, you know, in the top 5-6 picks here? Are we going to get, every year I say the same thing, and it's really generally proven true. At the beginning of the draft process, oh, there's not even a quarterback in the top 10. This is ridiculous. It's a terrible class. And then at the end of the process, you have four quarterbacks taken in the top 15. You know, almost every year, I think you could go back and generally see that kind of a thing. They get pushed up late, don't they? Are we going to see that again?
I think it's entirely possible. I mean, you look at, I think, Atlanta at 8 and Seattle at 9, and we don't necessarily think they're going quarterback, but maybe they both are interested in going for quarterbacks there. And if not, maybe that's where, you know, Pittsburgh starts calling at 20 to jump up to 8 or 9 to try to take if one of these guys falls. Like you said, it happens every single year. I'll say this. I think the top five is pretty solidified, but I think literally from pick 6 on, maybe Carolina is obvious with the quarterback, but from pick 7 on, I think anything could happen. I think anyone who's confident in what's going to happen should not be as confident as they are.
And Detroit, you're not seeing Willis go there.
I actually think it could happen. I think their philosophy and their mentality is we're not going to be picking this high again next year. Yes, they have two firsts again, but you know, a Rams first is probably 25th overall at best. I think they might consider it. Jared Goff has realistically one year left on his contract where then, you know, they can make a move. I think it's entirely possible they take him, redshirt him, and see what happens after that. It could be smoke, though, as well, for all we know.
My opinion of that, to get in on the Malik Willis to the Detroit Lions at number 2 overall, no one benefits more than getting that news out than the Detroit Lions, right? The Detroit Lions' number 2 overall pick starts to become more valuable. There's trade-down opportunity. Malik Willis is viewed higher. Some teams think, oh, man, I got to trade with the Lions if I want Willis. Could they be considering him? Absolutely. I think it's more likely they're not. I think it's more likely they're looking at Trayvon Walker or one of these other players, but are trying to send some of that smoke out there, right? Too many people have heard the same rumor that the Lions are interested in Malik Willis, number 2 overall, for them to have legitimate consideration, right? I do think that they're looking at other players, and it's more that the Detroit Lions want everyone to think they're interested in Malik Willis. So they get a call from the Seahawks and they get a call from the Panthers and they say, hey, if you're looking at Willis, we'll come up and get him. And we'll come up and get him, trade two first or whatever it may be. And maybe it's Pittsburgh, maybe it's whoever. They only benefit from highlighting that they are interested in Malik Willis. So I do think that, could they draft him? Absolutely. But I'm buying more into this idea that they wanted to just increase the value of the pick.
To piggyback off that really quickly, in 2020, they took Jeffrey Okuda 3rd overall, and then we had Tua Tagovailoa at 5th and Justin Herbert at 6th. And it came out that they were trying to move down, and they just couldn't convince Miami or Los Angeles that they were seriously considering either of those quarterbacks. So I think you make a great point. I mean, they had Stafford on the roster at the time, but I think you make a great point there for sure, where they know you have to get that smoke going just so, so teams think they might have to move up.
But when you look at Dan Campbell and you watch the tapes, I mean, those guys, they want to maul people. They want to win by just crushing your spirit. And they're pretty good at running the football and coming off the ball and being physical and all that kind of stuff. If you were of that mindset as a head coach, would you not want the ability to run the football from the quarterback position because you're not really going to depend on your passing game anyway?
I think so. I mean, there's a reason to look at Malik Willis as a legitimate top option, right? I think they could look at him. They could look at Howell. They could look at Pickett, Ritter, all at number 2 overall if they feel that they can, like, move this forward, right? I think the bigger issue is that no matter what, whether Jared Goff plays 0 snaps next year or 1,000 snaps next year, you owe him, like, $30 million. So, like, why not maybe potentially punt on this quarterback class while you still have so much invested in that position and look elsewhere, right, and maybe look at 32? You know, they have the 2nd overall pick and the 32nd overall pick. And 32, you still get that 5th year option. It's often been a place where teams looking to trade back into the first round, go get a quarterback, they consider it. Why not wait at 32 and see in a quarterback class where there is a lot of murky evaluations? Everyone has a different QB1. I like Kenny Pickett. I like Malik Willis. Why not wait this process out? See if a Ritter falls to 32 or a Howell falls to 32. And if you're that interested in moving on from Goff and starting this search for a new quarterback, invest in Sam Howell, say at number 32 overall. And then when you go into next year, if he doesn't pan out, you don't see it, you go Josh Rosen with this whole situation and you grab someone else in 2023, right? I think too often, I think the biggest mistake teams can make is letting a decision in the draft impact them for 3 to 5 years, right? You see that with the New York Giants and you see that with the New York Jets and Sam Darnold, right? When you invest in a quarterback to a point where you are putting everything into him over the next 2, 3, 3 to 4 years, it can obviously set a franchise back. If you go full Cardinals with it and say, we drafted Josh Rosen in the top 10, now we're picking number 1 overall. Guess what? We're taking Kyler Murray and they are an infinitely better franchise for it. More ownership, more team decision makers need to approach those decisions like that. You can't pick a quarterback, even if you pick him in the top 10, top 15, top 20, you can't let him set your franchise back. You can miss on that player and bounce back as long as you don't do what the Giants have done with Daniel Jones. The Giants are habitually a bottom 5 franchise because they've hitched their wagon to a player they traded up for that has not panned out. And now they find themselves, you know, really struggling.
You know, it's so interesting, and I wish I got, actually, I don't wish, because it would take too long, but I would like to know what those interviews were like with these guys, because I feel like that when I go into the room with the quarterbacks, I kind of form an immediate opinion about, oh, I've seen the tape and I know what they can do and all that. But there are some people that are just it, you know, they just have it. And I wonder if Malik Willis is one of those guys that people just, you just kind of walk in there and you go, man, I'd really like to have that guy on my team.
I
It
agree.
sounds like it.
I think his character and all that stuff is of the highest level. I think he's a guy that there are questions. I mean, there are questions. He's 22, 23 years old, and you know, Auburn moved on from him for whatever reason and stuck out with what they had with Bo Nix. And even at Liberty, I don't think you saw his game develop all that much, right? Can you know, everyone says, oh,
I agree.
he can develop. Like, why isn't his? You know, I ask that question probably first, right? If I'm evaluating Malik Willis, I ask coaches why you don't think he's developed significantly over the course of his career. What do you think his ceiling is in the NFL? What does he need to develop? You know, we bring up the combine every year and we bring up, you know, production and stuff. You know, you talk to any evaluator, scout, you know, decision maker in the NFL, the number one thing at the combine is interviews. It's interviews with players, it's interviews with coaches, and it's talking to that player and people around him on what are the reasons why he hasn't been this perfect prospect in college football? I think I have a lot of questions to Hugh Freeze and Gus Malzahn, these guys that, you know, have obviously like looked at Malik Willis and made decisions elsewhere.
I can't tell you how much I count on the fact that generally I would be wrong. So if I were sitting there at number two and I chose one of these quarterbacks, then there's heavy odds, 50% or so, that you're wrong. You know, you just got it wrong. You just got the evaluation wrong. And if you could get somebody at 31, 32, whatever, at the end and get that fifth year, the odds are probably almost as good you're going to get it right with this quarterback class. Maybe not with all of them, but I keep going back to last year and all the angst that went around, you know, trying to put those guys in order and who's going where and trading up and all. The odds were just as good that you were going to be right with the fifth one taken as you were with the first one taken.
Yeah, no, 100%. And I think, you know, like guys like Mac Jones, I mean, Burrow probably, you know, went first overall, maybe not viewed the same way. But I think teams are also realizing, especially as we talk about playing early, maybe you do sacrifice a little bit of athleticism and potential for a guy that can run an offense from day one.
Unbelievable. You guys are great, man. I always enjoy the conversation and looking forward to the Aiden Hutchinson podcast. When does that actually come out? When do we start that?
April 13th, all four episodes were released on April 14th. It should be about 5 hours in total of content, starting with his upbringing, his, you know, freshman, sophomore, junior season, specifically the injury and how that impacted the Michigan football team. And then the last two episodes, personally, my two favorites, we go by game of the 2021 season there at Michigan and talk with, you know, we talk to opponent head coaches, right? I talked to Western Michigan, the guy that faced Aiden Hutchinson week one. He said, I didn't know what to do. I don't know what to do to block this guy. He's the biggest, you know, most dominant player he's seen since Aaron Donald, J.J. Watt, as some of the players that he mentioned. So a lot of really good detail on just what was an absurd season for the Michigan football program and obviously Aiden Hutchinson.
Yep. Now that I'm finished with Yellowstone, I'm on to Aiden Hutchinson. So
Let's
give me
go.
something to do. That'll be good. That'll be good. Austin, Brad, you guys are the best, man. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.